From Indiana to Oregon, South Dakota to South Carolina, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the National Labor Relations Board is unable to function as President Trump's nominees await U.S. Senate confirmation. Sean Higgins from the Competitive Enterprise Institute is here with details. The Schumer shutdown continues as congressional Democrats refuse to put up the votes needed to reopen the federal government. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Are artificial intelligence chatbots better at debating than humans? Eric Boehm and Ron Bailey of Reason Magazine are here to discuss. And do our rights come from government or are they God-given? The nation's founding documents give us the answer. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. With only one member, the National Labor Relations Board has effectively ceased to function. To learn more, we turn to Sean Higgins. He is a research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sean, welcome to American Radio Journal. Sean, the National Labor Relations Board, tell us what it is and what it is that it does.
The National Labor Relations Board is a federal agency that enforces the National Labor Relations Act, which is the main law covering unions in the United States. It's an independent agency. It's not part of the Department of Labor, despite what some people think. And it's an interesting in that it's simultaneously a sort of executive branch agency in that, but also has judicial function. It has administrative law judges that actually enforces the law. It has a five-member board that runs it, for the most part, but it's currently down to just one member. And in fact, as we speak this, it's also closed down because of the government shutdown. So it's not really doing anything at the moment. But even if the government were funded, it lacks a quorum to act. It's just the one guy, the chairman. Four seats are currently vacant.
What was the reason why the NLRB was even formed to begin with?
Well, it was basically to ensure labor peace. The purpose of it was to enforce the National Labor Relations Act, which is the law that says when a union is officially recognized by the government, and the government therefore uses the power of the law to force businesses to negotiate with that union. It was created in 1935. 1934 was a particularly bloody year in terms of labor strife in the United States, and it was a lot of strikes and a lot of interstate commerce shut down. And this was a particularly perilous point because the country was still sort of getting out of the Great Depression at the time. So there was a very real fear that if they didn't come up with some sort of official structure for administering these disputes, that the economy would remain stuck in the Great Depression for a while after. And then the basic purpose of the board exists today to basically be a manager or a referee between management on the one side and unions on the other.
And as you have mentioned, there's just one member currently on this board. How is it that we came to only have one out of five people on the board and not even a quorum to do business?
It's been a persistent problem with the board for the last couple of decades. There have been a lot of periods where they've had empty seats and periods where they've lacked a quorum to act, going back at least as far as the George W. Bush years and probably even earlier than that if I looked. It's one of those things where it's just always been a very sort of contentious issue because it's the board that enforces labor laws, and the president gets to appoint the nominees, the Senate gets to confirm them, and the president's party always tries to put a majority of their people on the board, and the other president's party tries to put a majority of their people on the board. And so the board has a history of sort of swinging from management side leaning decisions to union leaning decisions with each administration that comes and goes. And one of the ways in which the opposing party has reacted is by refusing to approve nominees for the board. So there's just these periods where seats go unfilled because they're just waiting for the next administration to come in.
I would assume at this point then that President Trump has made nominations to the board. Has he done that? And if so, are they awaiting Senate confirmation?
Yes. There are two people who have been nominated to be on the board. Scott Mayer, who is a former labor attorney for Boeing, and James Murphy, who is a longtime board staffer. They have hearings for the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee on October the 9th, which, as time we're recording this, is going to be tomorrow. But by the time you're hearing this, the hearings will have done, and they probably have been moved out of committee and before the full Senate.
In the absence of the NLRB, then, Sean, having a majority of members lacking a quorum, you've mentioned that a couple of states have taken advantage of that. Let's talk about that, beginning with the state of New York. What is happening there?
New York passed a law which literally says that the state labor board, which previous to this was, as I understand it, a public sector labor board, could step in and essentially be the enforcement of labor laws in the state. In other words, if you filed a labor unfair practices complaint or something like that with the National Labor Relations Board, which is the basic way in which enforcement cases begin, and nothing happens because there isn't a quorum on the board to act, then you could turn around and say to the state labor board, well, you come in and sort of adjudicate this dispute. This is a sort of significant issue because the reason why the National Labor Relations Act was created in the first place was to create a level playing field across the entire country. Conservatives often sort of point out how the Commerce Clause is used to justify all sorts of federal actions that don't really have anything to do with interstate commerce. This is the one case where interstate commerce clearly is involved, and therefore the federal government does have a role to step in and sort of level this. And basically the state government in New York under Governor Hochul has said, well, since the board is not going to be able to do anything, we're going to be able to come and step in and do it. And this creates a problem of, therefore, conflicting rules from state to state, which would be a very difficult thing and undermine the whole purpose of, you know, the National Labor Relations Act, which is to ensure labor peace.
Across the country in California, there's some chicanery afoot there as well?
Yeah, well, last week they passed a very similar law called AB 288, which again would allow the people in the state, if they believe that the National Labor Relations Board is not reacting quickly enough, to turn to the state and do it. The National Labor Relations Board has sued New York to try to get the law kicked out. I presume they will do the same thing with the California law because it's very similar. Massachusetts apparently has had similar legislation introduced, and there may have been other bills introduced in state houses across the country that just haven't popped up on the radar yet. This is one of those situations where once is a novelty, twice is a coincidence, three times is a trend, and clearly some unions are pushing friendly state legislatures to adopt these type of laws because of the vacancies on the National Labor Relations Board itself.
We have been talking with Sean Higgins, who is a research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sean, tell us a little bit about CEI, also a website you have written on this and related topics. Where can folks find those writings?
Yeah, well, the Competitive Enterprise Institute is a free market think tank. We're right here in Washington, D.C., in the belly of the beast. And you can find all of our stuff by myself and my very highly intelligent colleagues here at the Institute, so many of whom are much smarter than I am, at CEI.org.
Sean Higgins of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sean, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
The Club for Growth remains open for business in the nation's capital, and Scott Parkinson is at work. Can't say the same for the federal government. We're going to talk about that. Scott, good to have you back with us.
It's my pleasure.
And so the Schumer shutdown continues. Been a lot of back and forth this past week. Has any progress been made, Scott, toward resolving this shutdown?
I think it's one of those instances where the Democrats are pretty dug in. They have repeatedly voted against reopening the government and voted to keep the government shut down. John Thune is entering what are known as motions to reconsider on the House-passed bill, which was a bipartisan bill. It did have a Democrat that voted for it, but it was a nonpartisan extension without any real anomalies. And what that bill would do is would fund federal government through November 21st. And the Democrats are refusing to go along with that in the U.S. Senate. For the most part, there's been a couple of Democrats that have been voting with the Republicans, but Chuck Schumer is feeling all this heat and pressure from Mamdani and AOC and other New York liberals. He's also feeling some pressure from Hakeem Jeffries, another New Yorker that held most of the Democrats together. But you remember in Nancy Pelosi's reign of terror, she always used to say, "Show me the vote." And if you could show her the votes that you could pass a bill, then she was more likely to negotiate. And that's exactly what the House Republicans did. They showed that they could pass a bill. and the Senate Republicans have been holding strong, holding together. And it's really the Democrats and Chuck Schumer for this Schumer shutdown. What they are trying to do is extract a major concession from Republicans to pass spending for these enhanced Obamacare premium tax credits. You might remember during COVID, Joe Biden basically put the Obamacare subsidies on steroids to try to offset the cost of premiums for people that make even up to $600,000. And that's pretty outrageous when you think about the U.S. taxpayer funding Obamacare and the premiums for people that really don't need that sort of help. We obviously have the Medicaid program that is supposed to help low-income individuals, and that's also been abused by Obama and Biden and all the Democrats. Republicans in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act stripped the ability for illegal aliens to take advantage of the Medicaid expansion, and they also added work requirements, because if you are a healthy, able-bodied individual, you should be working, not on welfare. And that's really what the big goal was there. But the Democrats are trying to fight back, and I think that it's falling on really deaf ears, because the American people understand that Chuck Schumer is blocking this Republican House bill from going forward.
It's interesting here, Scott. It's my understanding that President Trump and Republicans are saying, we're willing to talk with Democrats about the whole Medicaid, Medicare issue, and the Democrats are just shutting down the government. Really, isn't the only thing that Republicans are asking for here is a few more weeks to work this out?
Well, what John Thune and Mike Johnson and President Trump have said is that they're happy to have a negotiation, but they will not allow the federal government to be held hostage by the Democrats. And instead, they are calling on the Democrats to reopen government and then resume bipartisan negotiations to deal with the increased cost of health care coverage. I think that you've also seen sort of President Trump step up to the plate this week. He struck a deal in the Middle East with Israel and Hamas, and hopefully we'll have those hostages released on Monday next week. But there's a lot of things that President Trump is able to continue to do in the executive branch while Congress sort of sits on its hands and has this congressional stalemate over the funding of the federal government. Trump, I think, is showing that the stock market has not been affected. It's been, I think, pretty strong over the last 2 weeks. And it's business as usual in terms of the way that the administration is moving forward enacting their agenda.
Let's switch now. We also like to talk about what's happening politically around the country. Congress, of course, very narrowly divided. Republicans only have a very small majority. There is an open seat in the state of Tennessee. Some action on that this past week. Want to bring us up to date?
In Tennessee, Congressman Mark Green decided to retire early from Congress following the passage of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. And that set up a big special election sort of in the Nashville suburbs, and you had a helicopter pilot that served in Iraq and Afghanistan named Matt Van Epps that ultimately prevailed in this primary. It was a competitive race because Van Epps sort of emerged from nowhere, rose in the polls, and we know from the early voting and absentee ballot breakdown compared to Election Day that Van Epps, he really surged in the final week. And I think he won the early vote about 41 to 26% over his closest competitor, a guy named Jody Barrett. Club for Growth Action and our super PACs opposed Barrett because last winter he opposed a school choice bill that ultimately became law that the club and Governor Lee and President Trump worked on together. And we said anybody that opposes school choice is going to be opposed by the club for higher office. And so we spent pretty close to $1 million in that race in the primary, and we endorsed Matt Van Epps late last week, the same day as President Trump, and Van Epps ultimately prevailed with about 51% of the vote. Now he'll move forward to the general election for this special election to fill the vacancy. That's going to be held on December 2nd. And there's a woman named Afton Bain that is the Democrat nominee the Democrats had a much tighter election to decide who their nominee was going to be. All four of their candidates finished above 20%, and I think Bain won with roughly 27% of the vote. So the Democrats have some work to do to unify their side more so than the Republicans with Matt Van Epps. Nonetheless, Loman, I think this is a safe Republican district. It's one that Mark Green never really had problems retaining, and we expect that to be a seat that Matt Van Epps wins on December 2nd, and he joins the Republican conference to continue to fight for President Trump and the America First agenda that's been working so well over the first 10 months of 2025.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the Club for Growth.
So Club for Growth is an organization that's based in Washington, D.C. We're united in that idea of economic freedom and liberty. For a long time, we've supported school freedom and school choice. And we also make sure that policymakers all throughout the country support school choice so that we can expand competition in the educational marketplace and give all students access to high-quality K-12 education. If you want to learn more about Club for Growth, you can visit us at clubforgrowth.org, and you can actually sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you so much for being back with us. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Artificial intelligence-powered chatbots have proven very good at debating humans. We learn more now from Eric Boehm and Ron Bailey of Reason Magazine.
They say that one of the seminal moments in a child's development is when it learns to lie, but I think maybe more important than that is when it learns to debate, when a person becomes intelligent enough to argue and to win an argument with another person, even if it's just, you know, a kid fighting with another kid. That skill, that's important, that means something. And we're starting to see whether artificial intelligence is maybe getting to that same level too. Hi folks, I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. Take a little break from the politics this week to ask the question about whether AI chatbots might already be better than humans at debating, or, well, at least they're convincing some humans with their arguments. That is the headline on a new piece that you can read this week in Reason Magazine, this month, I should say, in Reason Magazine from Ron Bailey, and he's my guest on the program today. Ron, thanks for taking some time and joining us.
I'm delighted to be with you.
So you take a look at this study. This was a study published in Nature Human Behavior earlier this year. Tell us a little bit about what happened here. This was basically an attempt to see whether artificial intelligence, ChatGPT, whether it could convince people of its arguments.
Right. What the researchers did was set up online debates basically between two humans or in between a human and a large language model, a chatbot, GPT-4 in this particular case. And in some of the debates, the researchers provided both the humans and the AI with basic personal information about their opponents, things like age, sex, ethnicity, employment, and political affiliation. What they wanted to find out is if such personalized information would help the debaters, both the human ones and the machine ones, to craft better and more persuasive arguments. And they did find that, in fact, that the AI, the chatbots, were much better at using personalized information to persuade their debate partners, whereas the humans weren't very good at it.
Does that mean that the humans just kind of fell back on the same arguments regardless of who they were talking to, but the AIs adapted and changed how they approached the debate?
That appears to be the case. One of the things they discover is, and it won't surprise you, is the chatbots more relied on logical reasoning, and because they could reach out to the internet and get facts and bring them to their debate immediately, they're better at deploying those, whereas the humans would try to talk to people about emotional arguments, more about trust, more about narratives and storytelling. So it turns out that deploying logic and factual knowledge does seem to be more persuasive, especially if you can craft it to address the particular concerns of your debate partner. In one particular case, they asked people, should every citizen receive a basic income from the government, a UBI? And so when the chatbot was debating with a middle-aged white male Republican on that topic, the AI highlighted the arguments that UBIs would boost economic growth and empower citizens to invest in their skills and businesses and basically improve the economy. And then when the chatbot was arguing with a black middle-aged female Democrat, the AI emphasized that it would function as a safety net, that it would promote economic justice and individual freedom. And that way it was able to craft more persuasive arguments targeted right at the people and their particular concerns. And it turns out that that works.
I suppose I'm heartened to know that the emotional arguments that the humans were using were not working on the AI. That makes me feel a little better about things. But as artificial intelligence, whether these things are actual intelligence or not, I understand is up for debate. For the purposes of this conversation, AIs like ChatGPT, as they learn more about us and they will continue to get smarter, it worries me maybe a little bit that they're going to be that effective at convincing humans of whatever they want to.
Right. Well, right now, I don't think that's a particular concern because the AIs are not acting as agents. They don't have the ability to say, well, I want to go out and persuade so-and-so of this and such. But what they can be used for is as tools by people, other humans behind them, as the researchers pointed out, they were very concerned about the persuasive power of AI accessing personal information. Because, and I'll quote here, they worried that malicious actors interested in deploying chatbots for large-scale disinformation campaigns could leverage fine-grained digital traces and behavioral data, age, sex, political affiliation, that kind of thing, and build sophisticated persuasive machines capable of adapting to individual targets. Basically, what you should be worried about at this point is that this ability to be persuasive by micro-targeting people will be deployed by humans who have an interest in persuading you of their particular point of view. That might be somebody trying to sell you a computer or floor wax, but it could also be somebody trying to sell you a particular political vision or provide disinformation about the wars in Ukraine, for example. So that was their concern, is that these could become persuasive machines deployed by agents who don't have your best interests at heart.
Yeah, I think that's particularly interesting. It's about the human behind the machine. The machine is really just a tool at that point. And as you say, possibly a tool to kind of superpower the political propaganda that's already out there. And certainly that is until and unless AI does become an agent, as you say, Ron, that is what these things are. They are tools, but they are tools that can make humans potentially much more effective at what they're already trying to do. But we'll have to talk about that another time because we're out of time for today. Ron Bailey, science correspondent for Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It was delightful to chat with you.
And once again, that is Ron Bailey. As I said, he's the science correspondent for us at Reason Magazine. Check out his latest piece in the magazine and at Reason.com. AI chatbots might already be better than humans at debating. You can debate that with your friends. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Our founding documents are very clear. Our rights are God-given, not given by government. But one U.S. senator hasn't learned a lesson. Dr. Paul Kengor, editor-in-chief of the American Spectator, has this American Radio Journal commentary.
Inspired by the funny TV show, Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader?, I hereby propose a new spectacle altogether. Let's call it, Are You Smarter Than a Senator? And I'm prompted by the extraordinary recent remarks by Virginia Senator Tim Kaine. And so, let us begin, boys and girls, with this question. Do we Americans believe that our rights come from God or government? If you answered God, which you probably did, then move to the head of the class. You're smarter than Senator Kaine. If you answered government, then sit in the back of the class with the senator wearing a dunce cap. And here's your text and reading assignment. Ready? Here it goes. We hold these truths to be self-evident, states our Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, these God-given rights, governments are instituted among men, unquote. Most fifth graders have learned this. Certainly, most Americans generally read it somewhere along the way. One would hope that it would have been learned by a sitting senator from the Commonwealth of Virginia, who was also, by the way, governor of Virginia, was nearly vice president of the United States. He ran as Hillary Clinton's running mate in 2016, and who graduated from Harvard Law School. And yet, here's what Tim Kaine said during a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing. Quote, "The notion that rights don't come from the government, but come from the creator, that's what the Iranian government believes. It's a theocratic regime that bases its rule on Sharia law and targets Sunnis, Jews, Christians, and other religious minorities," unquote. With a weird, almost jokerish sort of grin, Senator Tim Kaine continued. He said, quote, "And they do it because they believe that they understand what natural rights are from their creator. So the statement that our rights do not come from our laws or our government is extremely troubling," unquote. No, what is extremely troubling is that statement of 67-year-old Timothy Michael Kaine, who is, let me repeat for emphasis, a U.S. senator, former governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia, and a graduate of Harvard Law School. Needless to say, the notion that our rights come from the creator rather than government is the very foundation of the United States of America. It is a hallmark of our founding documents, as any child in an American school knows, or ought to know. This is, of course, rudimentary stuff, but Tim Kaine has it utterly upside down. His statement is not just wrong, but frankly flabbergasting. And it's easy to make fun of Kaine for this, as I'm doing, to dub him a dunce, as I have here. But in truth, this is quite sad and disturbing. Does he really not know this? Well, he's not alone, certainly among liberal Democrats. You might recall last year when Politico award-winning journalist Heidi Prisbola argued on MSNBC that what makes, quote, Christian nationalists such an extremist element is, quote, they believe our rights as Americans, as all human beings, don't come from any earthly authority. They don't come from Congress. They don't come from the Supreme Court. They come from God, unquote. So I ask, are these people really this uninformed? Do they truly not know that America is based on the idea of God-given rather than government-given rights? I hate to say it, but many probably don't. You would be shocked at how many Americans educated in our schools and at our liberal universities have neither studied nor read documents like the Declaration of Independence. You would be really shocked at how many law schools have not even read the U.S. Constitution. Oh, yes, I'm serious. If you don't believe me, ask some friends who are lawyers and went to law school. Ask them. You'll see. And sadly, in some cases, this is a willful ignorance imposed by secular progressives who have miseducated these people. Especially insidious, those responsible for this ignorance often desire it, including with other subjects, by the way, like socialism and Marxism. This ignorance makes it easier for radical secular progressives to try to do what they want to do. They supplant the crucial missing knowledge with their leftist ideology and theories. Education becomes indoctrination. And that's even more disturbing than the singular disturbing ignorance of Senator Tim Kaine. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengore. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WCCS-FM in Fort Pierce, Florida. Welcome to our new listeners in the Sunshine State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.